in some respects, I wonder if the presence of EDR in some of these systems actually indicates or suggests that people haven't really spent the time to lock down the system to begin with.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. We're coming in hot today. It is July 19th today while we are recording. And those of you listening will remember that was the CrowdStrike day, so to speak. So we got a lot of things to talk about today, and I'm sure we're going to jump right in. Welcome back, Mario Sunil. I hope you guys are doing well and not directly impacted too much by this CrowdStrike again.
Hug ups is all I can say for everyone out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stay strong.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, by the time that this airs, a lot of the postmortem will be done and so on. I've been personally, I think it's kind of ironic, if this kind of thing happens to a non-cyber company, all of the narrative is about that they think it's a cyber event. You know what I mean? If Delta on their own just has an outage, or the New York Stock Exchange does, all of the sidebar is about, oh, I bet it's a cyber and they're hiding it. But with this CrowdStrike thing, I haven't heard anything like that at all. People seem to take it at face value that it's an operational incident. Is that what you guys are hearing as well?
I'm trying to find the quote, but I think it was Leigh Honeywell who said, a bad patch is indistinguishable from a cyber attack. So, yeah, something like that. Anyway.
It's too early, but it just seems like some missed QA activity and went through. That's what I'm interested to hear is how some company like CrowdStrike that's very robust, has a very, you know, mature program, how would something like this have passed through their quality controls? I mean, they've been top notch for a long time.
They have. And look, now instead of 100% and perfect, now they're 99.99999, right? It only takes one thing, but they're still right most of the time. I mean, I'll tell you, I remember this really rang a bell for me because most of the major outages kind of in the world are related to deployments, right? They're related to mistakes on upgrades, deployments. So that's not new. And I remember having that happen. And we used to get at the stock exchange, we used to get immediate pings if anything happened. I mean, even if things were slow of is this a cyber event or not. And so we ended up building into the incident response process where if there was any operational incident above a certain threshold, cyber would get involved, we would open an incident, and we would look for reproducibility. That was the magic word, right? So we'd be talking to QA and talking to engineering and saying, oh, yeah, were you able to reproduce this issue in environment? And the minute I said yes, okay, thank you very much, and we close out and downgraded our cyber incident, and we had the answer ready for when the regulators came calling. That said, I recall a stock exchange outage. It's no secret because those are quite public. And I remember there was a guy on the floor of our own exchange, ironically, on CNBC. And we had a reproducibility. We knew exactly what happened. We rolled out the release. We put it in a different environment. Had the exact same impact, right? And yet this guy, a cyber expert, was saying on CNBC, the average dwell time for an attack is 200 and something days. So how can they reasonably tell us within 20 minutes that they can rule out cyber? So that was kind of what we were getting. And I'm not seeing any of that getting pointed at CrowdStrike today.
Yeah. You know, I think of it as, I still think it's quality control. So it would be something we can learn from that. Everybody can learn from that experience. But the other thing that I was noticing is that only companies using Windows were impacted with this patch. And so the red team person in me, my antennas automatically go up and I'm thinking, wow, all these companies are using Windows machines in this kind of environment or in this kind of process. So now I have an idea of potentially how to target them next. If I'm a bad person. Yeah.
And you know, they're using CrowdStrike too.
Yeah.
You know, quite a bit.
Yeah. And you know where they're using it. So for airlines, you can kind of get an idea for all these. Now yeah. you, if I'm a ransomware person and or an attacker, now I have a bit of a map potentially of how I can harm these companies.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that I was thinking through, though, is if I actually have EDR on some of these systems that are intended for single purpose use, then what does that say about the rest of how it's configured? Because I would argue that if I've locked down my system to be, so if it's a single purpose function, if it's a workload, if it's a server or some kiosk or like an ATM, let's say, what we would do is to lock that thing down so tightly that you really couldn't do much of anything without tripping a bunch of alarms. And sure, if we wanted to put on EDR, I would put that, that's like one of the last things we would put on. It's sort of like AV, right? AV is at the very, very last stage if we even chose to do that. So in some respects, I wonder if the presence of EDR in some of these systems actually indicates or suggests that people haven't really spent the time to lock down the system to begin with.
Yeah, I think you're onto something big. And look, let's break it down. So CrowdStrike's in two games, if you think about it. They're in the EDR game, right? And for the layperson that's monitoring telemetry and be able to see what the hell happened after the fact or to get alerts. But the other side of it is what, and I was never a Gartner subscriber, so I'm totally off-piste when it comes to the acronyms, so forgive me. But I always call it EPP, Endpoint Protection, right? The evolution of antivirus, so killing stuff when it runs. And I was never a fan of putting that on, say data center servers. Because right? I always said, is somebody surfing the web on the server? Like, well, why don't we stop that instead of trying to deploy whatever it may have been at the time?
Exactly.
So, you know, to a degree, and by the way, I mean, to your point, I don't think that people rushed out CrowdStrike because they didn't lock it down otherwise. I think they rushed it out to tick some box of like, yes. Oh, we got the security.
Yes.
And I heard at least one anecdote today about a company who was absolutely smashed by this thing because of BitLocker, because they were also doing local encryption on these things. And I'm not talking about laptops. I'm talking about server side, the data center. And to me, it's the exact same thing. You know, regulatory examiners stomp into the room. Are you doing encryption at rest? And instead of examining it, doing a risk assessment, deciding whether or not it's relevant, instead it's, oh, yes, sir, let's go. Boom, 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 let's drop off BitLocker. Are you doing antivirus? What's antivirus? Is it CrowdStrike? Go, boom, boom, boom. And it all sounds good, but what I think this calls into question is the idea of, well, it can't hurt. I don't think that's so true anymore, well, it can't hurt. I think anything can hurt now, and you have to say, well, let's only do things when we have a very intentional reason behind it.
Yeah, I think we've all gone through cyber insurance, like, you know, annually or biannually, and I can recall the last time that I went through one of those where Windows and protection, EDR protection was required. I mean, you had to explain to the insurance brokers why you weren't doing some sort of EDR on
the
your
server
Windows
side?
Machines. Yeah, on the server side as well, absolutely. I think it was Falcon Complete that was impacted, right? Or their version of Falcon Complete or something. So they're also including, CrowdStrike's moving into the vulnerability scanning. And now they're doing vulnerability scanning on your endpoints, on your servers. And they're saying, why buy, quote unquote, the Oracle's, the Wiz's, the Tenable, when you can actually do CrowdStrike and save more money and include it part of your package. I wonder if people are starting to use CrowdStrike for that as well.
Well, the two are closely related because I do remember, and insurance is weird because insurance tries to say you have to have this. It's more pass-fail, whereas regulatory exams, if you're actually allowed to talk to the regulator, they're often not pass-fail. But if only the lawyers talk to the regulator, and then they turn around and say, hey, they said we had to have, and they didn't really say they had to have it. They just asked if you had it. And, more than endpoint protection on devices, I would hear about vulnerability scanning all the time. And I remember fighting that battle in particular and saying no. And you guys are probably going to even think I'm crazy for this, but said, no, we're not going to scan endpoints. We're not going to do vulnerability scanning on laptops and desktops. By the way, if you spend a lot of time fighting that, because if you win that one, think about all the how much easier your jobs would have been if you aren't trying to freaking mangle all the metrics that come off of your phone scanning because of desktops.
Like 4J on your desktop?
Yeah. That's the exact point. You don't care about that. I don't care about that. Why the hell are we burning cycles trying to, you know, reportray that in the reports that are going to go to the board and then over to the regulatory examiners and all that?
Yeah, I think ultimately the way I try to encapsulate this, it goes back to the question that you asked in terms of what's the harm? What's the harm in scanning endpoints? What's the harm in adding EDR? I think the harm is complexity. Once we keep adding more complexity as we add more of these security controls, some of them which are not based on any sort of risk management construct, but rather just because, again, we checked the box. Uh-huh. And once we cross a certain threshold of complexity, we can no longer really understand how one fix affects the rest of the system. In fact, they tend to cause new problems, these new fixes, and we don't really know what those problems are, and they're just waiting to be exposed. And I think we've gotten to a point where we've long exceeded that threshold of complexity, and we should really rethink, okay, what are the things that are essential for these types of systems? And go back and try to make it simple again.
As I think about this, and I'm not in the world of shaming the victims, I recall in my previous shops, before updating some sort of software, we would run it on some test laptops or servers, reboot your server, go through the whole process, and see if there was something that happened with it. And I'm wondering, why didn't some of these other companies who have now had this problem, did they go through their own QA testing?
But I think the value prop in, not EDR, but the EPP, so meaning that half of it, the protective side of CrowdStrike, the value prop is in the auto updates. I mean, that's what they're selling, is our threat intelligence is going to be deployed so that the minute that there's this new TTP observed in X, Y is going to benefit from that intel, and therefore it's encouraging people to update automatically, no?
So, okay, on that front, let's consider something here. And again, there's more data coming out, but this appeared to be a content update, meaning a detection logic update. So why would a detection logic update cause a kernel crash of some sort? There was a detection logic update that CrowdStrike released back in June that caused a whole bunch of machines to spike their CPU. That kind of makes sense. And the only way to recover from it was to reboot the machine, but it didn't cause a machine reboot. Okay, so something happened here where what should have been a simple content update was also packaged with something that destabilized the system as well. And I think there has to be a clear separation between those. If you're gonna do content rollout, then there's no reason why we should have kernel, you know, crashes and that kind of stuff.
I mean, the fact is, if you have an ultra sensitive environment, you don't update anything, right? Because there is no, well, this is okay because of X. And the example I use a lot is, I remember about 20 years ago, I was doing a million jobs, including network architecture, engineering, whatever, and I was manually updating routers. And I remember filing a change control ticket to make a production change on a router, doing it during the change window. Look at me, I'm paying attention, I'm doing the right thing. It was like, I think, a Friday night window. And everything went great. Went to bed. Some point Saturday morning, I remembered, oh, I forgot to save it. I made the change on a Cisco router. And if you remember from your Cisco router days, right, I remember you had to do write mem, or WR mem, right? Because it's in the running memory, which is great, but you have to write it to the non-volatile memory or it won't survive a reboot. And so Saturday morning, I woke up, and we were open and live on Saturday morning, so it was production outside the window. I thought, oh, shit, I forgot to save the thing. So I SSH'd on in, even then via VPN. It wasn't hot off the internet. And I did write mem.
With MFA.
Yeah. Secure ID, RSA.
Secure ID.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Right. So I got into the thing, wrote write mem, brought down the whole market. Bad chip, bad NVRAM chip. Minute you go to write to the thing, crashed. Hardware. The point is, I could have said a million years, nothing was bad can happen from this. You know, it's not my fault. What was I supposed to do? But that's why you do change freezes, right? So there is no innocuous change if you're at that extreme. But on the other hand, you accept the risk sometimes and say, well, we're willing because of the benefit.
You know, Sunil, I hadn't heard that it was like a feed update as opposed to a software update on CrowdStrike. I thought it was a software update.
Yeah, and again, from CrowdStrike, they say it's a content update. What does that mean?
Mm.
To me, that implies it's like a feed update.
Mm.
Well, it had a version number and it wrote a file to a disk, so
yeah,
a little bit fat.
Which to me, it means that they're combining they should separate those two out, create two different streams, right?
Yep.
Because I think we all want feed updates. We don't necessarily need the other one. And I would also argue in the context of a server, a locked down, tightly bound server where we've done lots of segmentation, where we've done application allow listing, all the things that you would want to do on a server, I don't know if I need a feed update.
Or a product.
Well, I may still need some sort of detection logic that says, hey, someone's trying to bypass the allow listing controls that I have, because there are ways to bypass, but the ways to bypass are not unknown at this point. We know what, those are known things that doesn't require a feed update.
Well, I mean, I think hindsight will show you know, exactly what happened, or what the lessons are, the lessons learned. I, for one, after going through so many crises of this type in my life, I bias toward saying, you know, you make the self-driving car and it hits a person and you don't panic and suspend the whole program. You look at the statistical data and say, wow, it's still a hell of a lot safer than a human's driving around. And there's a good chance that the hindsight from this is it's such an edge case. Yeah, it's going to happen every 23 years. Let's go with it. It's awesome. It's a hell of a lot better than pausing updates and not rolling security in general. And CrowdStrike has an amazing track record up through this point. So,
you think you could have that conversation with some of these impacted customer CEOs to tell them, hey, we should expect this to happen every 23 years?
I wouldn't. I'm smart enough to know that. No, it's yes, sir. We've done everything. Yeah, we're going to, and I'm going to have a bunch of to-dos and I'm going to tick them off and come back and show they're completed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember pretty well. I've told the story before, but not on the podcast. A coworker of mine in the early days at ICE, we had an issue with F5 networks, right? We were using F5 networks to broker trades. It wasn't just for load balance. It was like for the fixed protocol. It was awesome. A lot of bespoke logic on it and all that. And we had an outage. It was something to do with F5, and we worked closely with them, and they fixed it and rolled out something great. They were an awesome partner, all that. But they had a bug, and we had a major outage, and it cost revenue. Everything sucked. And we're in the room with the CEO, because in those days, that's what happened when I got an outage like that. And I remember it was just exactly what you guys are talking about. The CEO turned to my counterpart, who is now the CIO of the New York Stock Exchange, right? And he turns to Chuck, and he says, you know, we're all going through technical details and, you know, glossing over things really fast. And the CEO just says, well, hold on a sec. Chuck, who owned the F5s, said, Chuck, can you tell me that this isn't going to happen again? And Chuck, to your very point, instead of saying, well, we're taking all reasonable measures, we're going to do everything we can, he said, well, it's not outside the realm of human possibility.
Oh,
that was not a popular answer.
It was the honest, just the honest answer.
Yeah,
and
so
how did your CEO take it?
Yeah. Oh, I know exactly how he took it. He said, Chuck, you know, it's a good thing you don't report directly to me.
Oh.
So yeah, at the congressional hearing, I don't think the proper defense for CrowdStrike is going to be to say, hey, look, these things will happen every 23 years. That's a pretty good rate. Yeah, I know, but in the back of my mind, that's what I'm thinking.
Well, at least one should be able to say, whatever processes or whatever activities caused this particular issue, that will not happen again.
Yeah, yeah. But to me, again, just CrowdStrike, and I don't have any money on CrowdStrike, but they've been a stellar partner. They've been a good vendor, right? I mean, I have not heard. This is the biggest thing I've heard from CrowdStrike since I've known them.
Yeah, and actually, one other consideration of what makes them really good and what makes them, and what may have also contributed to this, is the fact that they caused the attackers to fight in our territory. Our territory being in an environment where their actions are very clear and seen and observable. And that's because of the model that they adopted early on, which is to be on the cloud and to be always connected to the cloud. And that model has been extraordinarily successful in, again, forcing attackers to fight on our territory, not on their territory, right? If you want to try to bypass CrowdStrike, then guess what? They'll see you try to bypass CrowdStrike, right? Okay, now that comes with the flip side of what we just saw, which is if you're always on and always getting the latest updates or some versions behind, well, you're getting all the updates and some version behind. And I don't know to what degree we can truly control that if we're operating in this sort of environment where we're always on, always talking to CrowdStrike. So anyway, it's an interesting trade-off. I don't know. To me, it seems like the net of it has been pretty good. And the world just got a free BCP test as a result of it. But you know,
yeah. Well, Mario, you touched on, you said you're not exposed to it financially. You're not invested in it. I am. So I want to talk about that. I hadn't been historically, just because I thought I missed the boat on CrowdStrike. I certainly loved and admired the company, but I took advantage of the opportunity this morning during this outage here. So with the preface for all three of us that we are not registered investment advisors, we are not giving investing advice, all the legal disclaimers here, just talking anecdotally. I bought some CrowdStrike when I saw what happened here on the dip, because I think that this will not impact their share price midterm, even forget about long term. And I think that this is a nine-figure marketing deal they just got. They are on every news outlet. Every human on the planet's hearing about the name CrowdStrike and hearing what they do. And the main takeaway they have is, oh, my God, I can't believe every airline runs this thing and every other company. And to me, this is just a huge windfall for them share price-wise, I think.
There's a very perverse part of me that would also say, if I were their lawyers, I would say, thank God we don't have software liability.
Yeah. So what do you guys think? Let's play a game here with predictions. Are you willing to put out a, they were, before this happened, they were trading at $340 a share. It's so far dipped down to about 290 something. And right now it's about $305 a share. You guys have an idea of when we go live on July 26th with this episode, you have a prediction of the closing price for Thursday end of market?
Closing price, I don't know. But I guess the question is, you think it'll be up or down? That's maybe, we'll start with that.
Up or down from what? From where we are right now or from yesterday?
No, from right now. So what, benchmark it at 305? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, George Shultz runs a pretty tight ship, so I'm hoping that they've developed a good crisis management playbook for, you know, at least how to manage some of these scenarios. I think people have been wanting to beat, there's a lot of people who've been wanting to beat this stock, and there's money in there, and I think there's still a dip. I still think they have another $5, $10, maybe $15 to go down. So that's my bet. I think it'll be around 290, maybe 280, high 280s. But again, George Shultz runs a pretty tight ship. I think they'll come out. They'll get a little bruised, but I think they'll come back. Nothing's telling me yet or sending me signals that this is a company that's going the wrong way.
Yeah. So Neil, what do you got? Are you willing to play?
All right. Okay. So here, I'm going to show you my app. Review order and buy. Okay. So I'm locking my price in right now.
So what does that mean? You're bullish? You think it's going to be up?
In a week, you said?
Yeah, end of Thursday.
So I'll say it's going to go up. So I'll go ahead and commit that in real cash here.
I'm going to go 332. All right, so wow. Up. Pretty good bit. I think it'll be over 350 in a month and back on a rally, but I think we'll get most of those losses back by next Thursday. So look, gamesmanship aside, the important part of this discussion is, you know, and I've had people ping me already asking what's the long term here? Is there going to be flight and onward? Okta was breached, right? And a lot of CISOs were saying at that time, like, are we going to leave all that? Still, most of them didn't even leave. This isn't even a breach. And then on top of that, you've got the entire investing planet that could care less about, you know, whether or not there was an outage right now, just recognizing this company and researching it and jumping in it. I can't see how this can have a long-term effect when an actual breach can't even shed customers from public companies. Well, are people going to switch? Do you think can you guys think of CISOs leaving? Yeah, I mean, if it happened once every, you know, quarter, we'd have a different situation. But once, I can't see anything to it. Another funny anecdote. So I lived through this before. 2004, there was a major internet outage. We were running an internet-based stock exchange. No, internet-based futures and commodities exchange at the time. And that meant we were really closely watching the internet because anytime customers would drop, we would actually call them up and say, hey, we want to let you know it was your internet connection that dropped, not us. So we had to make sure that was true. So we were really watching this closely. Microsoft had outages. Yahoo had outages. You guys may even remember. It was 2004, and there was a lot of outages all around. So we quickly paid attention. We saw some customers dropping and then realized that it wasn't us and very quickly figured out it was Akamai. Very quickly. And that was back before people really even knew what CDNs were in public, but we knew because we were technologists. And so I, through publicly available data, you know, trace routes, that sort of thing, figured out that Akamai was having an outage while the market was open, and I shorted it. You know, it's the exact same thing. Big outage affecting a lot of people, affecting a lot of companies, and I shorted it, patted myself on the back, and went back to doing whatever I was doing for work. And I totally lost my ass on that. Nobody knew what Akamai was until the outage. And then everybody found out that Microsoft uses this company called Akamai, eBay uses this company called Akamai, Yahoo does, on and on. So the thing went popped way up, and I closed out at a loss and all of that. And so maybe that's why I'm so bullish on CrowdStrike now, is that I feel like the pattern's going to repeat itself. We'll see. So on a related note, let's talk about switching costs a little bit, right? Because even before this thing popped, we were already planning on talking about a story about Rapid7, which drove the same thing. It was an activist investor saying that they were going to force Rapid7 to sell. And by the way, companies buy and sell all the time. That doesn't mean you go out of business. And yet, even then, people were prognosticating whether CISOs would fly from the company just because it might be sold. Let's talk about, I think switching costs are low, but that people only leave when there's a legitimate reason and not because they're afraid they might have to leave at some future point. How do you guys feel about that when you're looking at vendors and whether or not they might have solvency issues or even kind of, you know, major corporate actions coming up?
Well, it's something that we actually write into. It's something that I would suggest people write into their contracts anyway to say that if there's a change of ownership, that we have the ability to kill any prior agreements, you know, whatever it may be, if you have a multi-year contract. We had that as standard language. I would suggest others probably continue to include that as standard language, because it becomes negotiating leverage when there's a change of ownership that says, hey, look, I expect the same level of service, one. I may even want a discount, who knows, too. But just giving people notice that you really do expect them to have the same, continue to deliver the same level of service, if not better.
Well, hold on a minute. So are you saying that in the contract, you guys would try to say, look, if there's a change in ownership, we reserve the right to cancel this contract? Or would you say only if there was a degradation?
Nope.
Yeah. I hate you, Sunil. First of all, you run a startup today, and when you go to Bank of America and they try to taint all of your deals so that when you go to sell to CrowdStrike, CrowdStrike says, whoa, hold on, 100% of your ARR is at risk if we buy you? You're going to hate Bank of America yourself that day.
I may, but I can understand. Hopefully people understand why that provision's in there.
Yeah, I'm half joking, but there's bullies in the TPRM game and in the contract game.
Yeah.
That's a bully move.
Well, I'll put it in a context as well. If your technology, so in the context of Rapid7, what is the switching cost? And the switching cost might be pretty low, right? Let me point out another vendor for which the switching cost was extraordinarily high, despite many changes of ownership. Anyone remember the company called Vontu?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone still doing business with who? Broadcom? Wait, what is it? Oh, no.
Symantec first, right?
Who owns that now? I don't even know. But I mean, it was hard to. It wasn't. That was not an easy switching out of that. Was not. I don't know if anyone. I don't know if people have switched out of it. There are still people probably having to rely upon that technology. Why? Because it freaking worked.
I don't. We've never. I don't recall doing one where we did. If you were bought by somebody else, that we had the right to replace you. We did put degradation of service, right? We did say that if your service is degraded, then it's kind of interesting to do that, Sunil, because the security space, I mean, at least in the last 2 years, it's acquisition galore, man. I mean, maybe even longer than 2 years. And so it's really hard in the security space to try to do that. Generally, we've stayed with those vendors unless there is a mass movement of employees leaving the company because they don't like it. And if those employees play a key role, quality control or research, etc., whatever they were providing us, the service they were providing for us, if the employees start leaving, that's kind of a concern.
But look, I think, I mean, Sunil, not to point you out, I'm sorry, but you know, you're the messenger here, but you're representing like this big boogeyman. But that's a poison pill. And I would think a lot of investors and capital markets folks, when they hear that kind of behavior was going on, they'll be, oh my God, am I glad that's not rampant? Because you can't value a book of business if the entire thing is at risk if you do the deal. Right? Doesn't that sound awful? Mario, you're launching a startup too. How would you feel if a big customer wanted to throw that in there?
I wouldn't sign it.
But it's Bank of America.
Well, and by the way, it's not just I've seen on the receiving end now. I've seen this, and it's not just my former employer. I've seen it in other places as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can see people trying that. It's all a leverage game. I mean, and TPRM's the same way. So, you know, you'd almost see like Bank of America versus Snowflake. Now there's a big successful company that could maybe afford to walk. And it's just going to be whoever needs the other one more is who's going to win that argument.
That's right. It's negotiating leverage at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, everybody wants the big logo of Bank of America, and small startups are, if that's the only way through it, you're going to take it and say, well, that's fine, because by the time we sell our company, we're going to have another 80% of revenue without that provision in it. Doesn't it hurt to know that the provision you're forcing on someone simply isn't sustainable, and that I'm expecting you to only take this from me? I know you can't take it from me, but only me. I'm special.
And usually what I've seen is when somebody like a Sunil, and I'm not calling you out, Sunil, I'm just using you as an example, right? But if somebody would do that, what would often happen is I would get in on a call with you, Jerry, or you, Sunil, and start talking about, okay, I get that you need this. What else can I do? I think degradation is probably what you're concerned about. Maybe we can focus on that and put that in the language of contract. But doing this other thing you're requiring us to do, that's just it's too big of a climb for us. So usually there's a negotiation factor going on there. And I've never heard what people walking away, especially if the tech is good. I haven't heard people walking away. And I think usually you find some middle ground.
Well, yeah, I mean, I still think that on balance that, you know, with security tooling, that switching costs is pretty low and that people aren't going to run away just because they're worried about where the company will be, because new security solutions come out so fast anyway that you kind of switch organically. Right? You just move to the better solution on short notice. So you generally have to be ready, especially when it comes to vulnerability scanners and passive tools and that sort of thing.
And one other quick comment I should make about the example I gave earlier. One of the reasons why it was so hard to switch out of some of these companies, or the ones that were hard to switch out of, they had patent protection around their technology that made it hard for others to copy. Which then brings up to some degree the conversation around Orca and Wiz, which, you know, Orca had that patent protection, but somehow Wiz was able to get around that anyway. Yeah. We'll see how that plays out.
So speaking of Wiz, right, that's been some big news in the last week or so. There was and you guys keep me honest here if there's been an update on this story. Last I heard, it was kind of a strategic rumor or a rumor that Google was near a $23 billion deal to acquire Wiz. I'm assuming it's still just at the rumor phase and nothing more than that. That's a big number, right? That's what almost double the crazy $1 billion raise that was announced at the tail of the RSA conference just a few months back. In no particular order, my big two questions to pose to you guys are, one, do you think it's actually going to happen? And two, do you think it's a good deal for Google in particular, but for either side?
All right. So the latest on this came out, I think, a couple of days ago. And it's interesting in the context of PRs, press releases, and how they're weaponized for different reasons. Wiz is well known, I think, or at least it's known to weaponize press releases to their advantage. This one, I wonder if this was done against them effectively to pressure them towards a deal. Because as we many of us know, they were going towards IPO, right? So why all of a sudden switch to being acquired? And there's a story that was released a couple of days ago that suggests that this was the work of Andreessen. So if you are a investor and you just put $1 billion into an investment into them, and that was only, what, three months ago, and you can turn around and get roughly about, I think, about 1.92 times return, okay, in 3 months, I'll take that to return every day, every, you know, as long as I possibly can. So anyway, the perspective here is that they may have been pressured by Andreessen to make this deal happen as well.
So sorry, just to be clear, the rumor, again, it was a speculation, is that they may have, that A16Z may have pushed for the deal or pushed to have this info leaked?
Both.
Huh. How do you think that this is a leak, right, in some way or another? It may be one of those fake kind of theatrical leaks. But do you think this leak will increase the odds of the deal getting done or decrease them?
Well, at this point, I haven't heard anything to suggest that it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing that would really help is that a leak of a potential deal might trigger other potential suitors to say, you know, get in line here. Where's your $26 billion offer from Microsoft or whatever it's going to be?
Yeah, and that's another thing that I was somewhat curious about. So let's suppose now Google acquires them, and you use Wiz for AWS and to lock down your AWS environment. What do you suspect that they're going to continue to – where would you expect them to continue to invest in capability? In supporting GCP or in supporting AWS?
And Sunil, I'm glad you said that, because that's the first thing I thought, why Google would buy them. And if I wanted to understand my competition, if I really wanted to understand how Azure, AWS, and not only that, but also those customers of AWS and Azure that are also competitors of Google, of GCP, my goodness, imagine the wealth of information they're going to get out of this. They're going to know their competitors, how quickly they patch things, how do they look. Just on the data, I also don't know how many customers Wiz has, but it has got to be hundreds, right? We're not talking a handful.
Yeah. I mean, but here's the question, though, that I'm asking, which is, on if you're not the customer, you put yourself in a Wiz customer's shoes, and you're heavily in AWS and Azure, okay? Not GCP, but you're heavily in AWS and Azure. Going back to the change of ownership clause that we talked about a moment ago and the degradation of service, are you going to be, how confident are you that the service isn't going to degrade here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It doesn't make a ton of sense to me because, I mean, I know anecdotally that most companies that are in the cloud, super oversimplification, and actually, Sunil, you probably have a better viewpoint on this, but I would say are in AWS. I think that's, you know, still the go-to. So by extension, I would say that the majority of Wiz's accounts or touch points, let's say, are AWS. So how does it make sense for Google to own them? And then you have, like, antitrust, right, is just killing deals left and right these days. So you just have classic monopoly power type threats anyway. But then on top of that, you have this potential threat from Google to a competitor who happens to be a critical infrastructure supplier, right? A key concentration is AWS. God forbid you touch AWS. Regulators are all over that. So I just see too many reasons why this thing could get scuttled. And you know, if Google is doing the math and saying, yeah, we know we're going to shed a bunch of customers, some because they're scared, others because of whatever our strategy may be for this, and we know it's okay, in that case, they'd be paying for a loss on purpose as a defensive move, which also isn't going to go over very well. So my long shot prediction is that this thing isn't gonna close. I don't know the reason, but I have a lot of candidates out there. And if it doesn't close, we got like kind of the Adobe Figma merger in reverse. When Adobe was going to ruin Figma, buy Figma. I felt like when that deal got scuttled, which if I remember, I was $20 billion as well. I felt like that was the end for Adobe and great news for Figma, because I always felt like they could do a lot more on their own and that they were a lot more forward-leaning. I feel like it could be kind of the opposite here. Google's fine either way, but I think it could be really impactful for Wiz, especially if there's some optical fallout from this deal and people do start. We talked about switching costs earlier, but if you're worried, you know, how much are they going to care about my AWS environment when it's owned by a competitor, I could see CISOs especially. And by the way, people, in my opinion, have been on the fence with Wiz. There's a lot more competitors out there. You know, that's the scuttlebutt I hear is, you know, maybe we're looking at this alternative. I could see them being pushed over the edge during this 9 to 18 months it's going to take it for a deal like this to get done, even in the best circumstances.
See, I think what Google's going to do, and just looking at from their past history, like when they bought, you know, I think it was Aluma. They bought Aluma. We used to use Aluma. I think it was an ETL tool for security 4 or 5 years ago. What did they do? They told us a year later, within a year, that we had to leave because they weren't going to support us. Our competitor of GCP. Look, maybe they don't really care about AWS or Azure from like supporting them. Maybe this is a total play to make their security program better. Look, Wiz bought Gem Security. They acquired Gem Security like 3-4 months ago. That's a great security company that can help with your, you know, your CICD, your production environment, and all of that. All of that can just, you know, improve GCP's story. And Wiz can also improve GCP's story as a whole package to compete against Azure, to compete against AWS. Yeah, so what if we lose some clients that were using AWS vis-a-vis Wiz or Azure? Come to GCP. We're going to give you better security.
And then let me offer, though, people don't choose GCP because of security. It's the developers that choose GCP. So And they're not choosing it because of security. They're choosing it because it works.
Yeah, I don't think security is a differentiator among any of the big three or four cloud platforms at all. So I think there's a lot of question marks about what the strategy is here, what Google's after. But I don't know. I just feel like there's a lot more scenarios where this thing doesn't work out. And it feels like it could be pretty bad for Wiz to be dragged through this for, again, 9 to 18 months and then have it unwound while all their competitors are snapping up customers left and right.
Yeah, but like you said, Wiz has done this to them, to other people before, right? Wiz is not they could be a little bit, not the nicest of companies out there when it comes to, you know, spreading stuff like this.
Yeah, and don't forget too that Wiz has it spends a lot of money. It's not like they're a 90% margin company here that, you know, can afford this. You know, if there's attrition as a result of this and then the suitor walks, it could be pretty impactful for Wiz. So wish them the best, but I don't know. I'm bearish on that deal getting done myself.
Yeah, in that article I was mentioning, it mentions that they lose about 50 cents per dollar of sales.
Okay,
What do you think what is it going to do to folks like Orca? Like, I've looked at Orca and Wiz, and like I'll just say it. They're very similar products, man. It's almost like an island in talent when it comes to enterprise browsers. But do you think this is going to help Orca? Because from what I've heard is Wiz has been beating Orca in a market significantly. Mm-hmm. And I still don't know. If it's true, I still don't know why, because I think they're both very equal products.
Well, going back to my comment earlier about the lawsuit, I think it's supposed to go to trial like next year sometime. Mm. So that's a liability that I mean Google can pay for it, but it does hang over Wiz's head.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, you know, screening venture deals and that sort of thing, I see another cloud security posture management startup like every 20 days. If you think about the advent of infrastructure as code, and for any given startup these days, the amount of engineers and resources you have at automating the provision of cloud resource, right? And you wind back 10 years ago, and that wasn't the case. It wasn't ubiquitous. Developers were just kind of stitching together the cloud environments. Today, everything's automated infrastructure as code. Everybody who's gone through that for their own company to help deploy and mirror is pretty damn close to being able to write a great CSPM. Right? I mean, that's what it is, right? You pull all the infrastructure. You have to make sure you know exactly what it is before you can automate any changes to it. And while you're at it, why not assess the security posture? So I'm not surprised there's a lot of startups in this space.
Yeah, I think so if the question is there a capability to do CSPM and how good is that capability? I think that has become largely, I may be at risk of saying this, but largely commodity.
It is,
I think
yeah.
What Wiz has really done well is making the experience of it much, much better. And so I think that's the thing that made people really happy.
Well, I think to your point, again, I think it's become a very commoditized space. Even Wiz themselves has said that in the actions. They've moved into more forensics type of capabilities. So not just vulnerability, right? The buying of an example, they bought Jam, and they need their. I mean, I don't know. This was a rumor that they were going to acquire Lacework. Remember that? Is that? I mean, it's a rumor. But right, yeah. And I mean, but they were looking for Lacework because of the agents. Because doing forensics with just doing snapshots in your cloud provider, it's not going to be enough, folks. You need some sort of agent capability. So just to highlight what Sunil is saying, I think just the cloud posture, security posture space and vulnerabilities, it's too much commodity. You got to move up the stack and bring some more features.
To protect your multiples. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you're willing to say, okay, the market is saturated, we won, that's great. But if you're floating at a multiple on a valuation that's based on a continued growth rate, and you need to deliver a story on how you're not just going to sustain $500 million ARR, but how you're going to make it to $2 billion, then you have to move adjacent in all these other spaces, up stack and so on. And I think that's kind of a tenuous position to be in. I don't know a great story on them getting to $2 billion ARR very quickly and beyond. Okay, so changing gears here. Totally different topic. In the old SolarWinds debacle with the SEC, there's been some breaking news about the SEC dismissing most charges against SolarWinds. I think this is should be met with some sigh of relief from a lot of CISOs that were kind of worried about, you know, what the precedent would be around this. But do you guys, were you surprised by this, or is this what you expected?
I think after I sort of kind of did, because what happened with the Supreme Court case just a couple of weeks ago, where they pushed back on some federal agencies overstepping their boundaries. And they said that was not part of what the law was stated. And so they I don't know if it was the SEC, but they went after several different federal agencies. And so I think the signal was to a lot of these federal judges is that you can kind of, the SEC potentially has gone outside of what their charter was. And in the absence of any law that allows the SEC to do X, then maybe they got slapped. I know their intentions were good. I think the SEC's intentions were good. But they might have just gone outside of the boundaries of what the law allowed them to do.
The dismissal was 107 pages, so I didn't read the whole. I can't claim I read the whole thing. I could probably just search in it real quickly to see if there's any reference to Loper, which was the case that Mario just mentioned that was decided a few weeks ago. I don't think it was... I don't recall, well, not that I saw, read through it all, but I didn't see any reference to the prior case. So I'm not sure if it would have made a difference in this particular situation, partly because the issue, one of the issues that was dealt with in the Loper, the recent Supreme Court case was around the administrative judges, and this is not an administrative judge, this is within the Southern District of New York, I think. So anyway, it's a different thing. But that said, there was something that was interesting in the context of this case, which was the whole notion of what kind of controls is the SEC in charge of overseeing, okay? And, of course, one would assume it's financial controls. And is cybersecurity controls part of that? And the judge specifically said, look, if the SEC is trying to go beyond financial controls, then... what's the limit? Where are we gonna put that boundary? Because if you're starting to say cybersecurity controls is a part of that, then who's to say that any number of other controls wouldn't also be part of the SEC's remit? And I think that was a really valid point. And part of what I believe was one of the fatal flaws of the SEC case, which is they've extended really beyond their authorities. And anyway, so, but what was within their authority was statements that were made before the breach. And so this is, Tim's not fully out of the woods here yet. And I think that one of the real questions and concerns that we should have as CISOs is essentially, what are those statements that we signed up for, okay? And to what, how will they be scrutinized with respect to, from the eyes of the law, how will they be scrutinized? And this is, we're entering new territory here, because I don't think that has really happened before, where now, if you look at the filing, I mean, they went, they said, hey, you said you were a one on the NIST maturity rating here, and you were a two over here, and like, that's a level of detail that I don't think most people really expect from a court of law.
They dismissed 4 out of 5, right? They kept one, right, Sunil?
Right.
Yeah.
So the dichotomy was they pretty much dismissed any of the statements that occurred after the breach. There was only one charge that was tied to the statements before the breach, and that was kept.
Yeah, I know. Since go on this one, I've been thinking that it's like you shampoo, right? And you hear about calming shampoo, marketing statements that are made. I think that's about as criminal as, you know, we really care about security and we operate robust security controls and all that. They're kind of one and the same. I mean, that's what's been going on here. You know, we're in a world of marketing where there's a ton of embellishment everywhere, and whether or not I like it, I don't know that it's in the SEC's purview to crack down on it.
And I would say we're all, we're all guilty of that. Okay. And this is not an integrity issue as much as the fact that we will try to portray ourselves as having a robust security program. And it is aspirational. Okay. We all have aspirational cybersecurity programs. If we truly, here's my argument. If you truly believe that your program is as robust as it is, then share every detail of it, because we would love to hear how you actually do that.
It's tough. You know, I was talking to a group about the about ironically the SEC rules on cyber disclosure, not necessarily related to this case, but in particular related to just companies in their 10K and disclosing things about their program generally. But I was saying that if we get to the point where companies have to use the language that's common in a risk statement, right, in a risk statement in a 10K, then instead of saying, oh, yeah, we have endpoint protection on all of our endpoints, which a lot of people say, always a lie. Right? There's never a way, unless you have two endpoints in your whole company. There's definitely some that doesn't have one. But you make that statement because what you mean is directionally, and most of the ones that we know about and, you know, within, there's a lot of little asterisks that you expect that float along with it. But if you were to say that in a typical 10K risk statement, instead it would say something like, our endpoints may be lacking protection. There may be malware deployed on them at any given moment. We can provide no guarantee that all of our endpoints might not have Guy Fawkes masks appear on the screen and catch on fire in the next 7 minutes, and on and on and on. Right? And that's what happens. If you read a 10K of any given public company, the risk statement is all like that. And then you read the marketing material, and it's totally the opposite of that. So maybe that's where we're headed. Maybe we're just going to all throw out that kind of stuff all day long. And we do on the 10K. The question is TPRM. When the customers are doing the diligence questionnaires about your security, what are they going to get?
Oh, okay. I think you just gave us a really great solution. Maybe we should just give the TPRM questionnaire to our lawyers instead. Have them answer it for us.
Oh, man. Oh.
Problem solved, right?
So I think about this whole SEC, you know, assertiveness of this program of theirs. And I'm going to try to take the positive point of view that they were trying to improve security overall. Okay? So I'm just going to say they had good intentions. Okay, so after a year and a half, or a year after the SEC's regular, has it been a year? I can't even recall anymore. But whatever the time's been, have we seen more information on a 10K? And so everybody's just overwhelming the system with everything like, oh, I'm just going to put it in there. I'm going to play it safe. But at the same time, has it improved security overall for all those companies? In other words, I'm just going to write it and tell everybody I got bad stuff going on, but am I really fixing it? So what's the point, right? I mean, if the SEC is trying to improve, or this effort of theirs is to improve overall security, has it really helped? Are we more secure?
I think there's an important distinction, and I think most people miss this. Every regulator, and I think if you're in a regulated industry, you need to step out of the room for a minute and go do your research on the regulatory remit and read the regs till you fall asleep and then do it again. Because they all have a very specific remit, and it's not altruism. It's not necessarily noble causes. So the SEC is not trying to improve security, and that's okay, because other people are. The SEC is trying to protect investors, right? So the SEC is basically saying, if you get hacked and all that, that's fine with us. Just make sure that investors were totally aware of the risk. So their sole mission is really transparency here, and that's what drove it. Now, there's other divisions of the SEC, like the Reg SEI bits, that are charged with protecting, because it's like the market itself, to make sure the exchange is up. But that's pretty rare and pretty minimal, for better or worse.
Yeah, so in that regard, I think that while the intent may have been maybe at some level, maybe this might also help cybersecurity, I think the perspective here is maybe they were doing it the wrong way, right? It may cause the wrong type of it will cause more of us to turn to our lawyers to be more fuzzy in terms of what we disclose or what we write or how we answer TPRM questions and so on and so forth. And that's not going to help in any fashion as far as I see it. Now, the question is, what will, maybe? You know, how should we really think about this so that we do actually get the kind of sharing that we want, that, that we get the transparency that we want? And the fundamental, one of the key things that the U.S. government realized as a part of SolarWinds was, dang it, we had this understanding of what was compromised or who was compromised. It's like 6 months before we all discovered it, okay? How come we couldn't get our own act together to find this out ourselves? And that's a legitimate question. But at the same time, I also have to say, look, this was a situation where, like, even Mandiant got compromised and didn't find out until, you know, a few days later. I mean, we're talking top-tier companies that got compromised. And they found there was a very lucky signal that they found that they caught that allowed them to investigate and see what actually happened. So this was not a normal attack. And while, yes, we would love to share information here, this was such a well-executed, targeted attack with a ton of resources committed at it that, and they were trying to remain as silent as possible. And yet, you know, they were caught because, or at least there was some signal that something unusual was happening. And we were unable, we as a community of practitioners were unable to put the pieces together. Anyway, that's kind of the driver, you know, why we want this transparency. And I think, you know, that's a noble thing. But I think I wonder if we're expecting too much in this particular case because this was such a such an edge case.
And you know, Jerry, you posed that a position before we talked about it, right? Where you're like, no, the SEC is not interested in necessarily improving your security; they're protecting the investors. Okay, let's play that a little bit out. Okay, so I don't have all the data. But my understanding has been that when a company experiences major data breaches, if you think about all the major data breaches, yes, their stock will drop significantly for a while, but it usually rebounds. Isn't that what the data says? Huh? So what is the SEC doing? I mean, if the point is protect the investors, okay, the investors are being what, protected for maybe 2-3 months dip? And somebody buys on him on the dip. I mean, I don't get it. So help me understand that, Jerry.
Yeah, I mean, look, again, it's about transparency. It's like if you're going to make self-driving cars and they might hit people, the SEC is okay with that. But in your risk statements, it should say, hey, we're going into this area and there's a risk of life, you know, risk of life and injury and that sort of thing. And of course, it has the ancillary, we therefore take all prudent measures to make sure this, that, and the other. But we want you as an investor to know that that's a risk. Case closed. I mean, it's fully disclosing it. So, I mean, as far as the risk goes, the SEC just wants the companies to be completely transparent about the fact that all these things can happen. But then beyond that, when you get to that, therefore we take all prudent measures, that's where I think we're kind of negotiating a little bit more of, like, what do companies need to say about prudent measures? And do they need to say things like, we try to deploy security tools, but we don't have a great budget. And so, no, we don't deploy the latest. Like, no one's doing that kind of disclosure right now. But is that what they're after? Well, we don't pay top notch. So our security people probably already left and went to a competitor if they were really good. And we're left with the scrubs, right? Is that what's going to be in the disclosures? Is that the reality? And if so, is that what you really need to do to be fully transparent?
So I'm going to quote or mangle his quote. But Ed Amoroso, I think when this first happened a while back, he said, look, the SEC should just put a blanket statement out there that says 100% of public companies are in some stage being attacked by foreign adversaries. Okay. That was clearly the situation here, right? I think, okay, that's just the norm. What more do you want? That's the transparency. We all have aspirational programs, and if you get hit, if our job is to try to, I think I made this analogy in a previous podcast, but you know, there's a distinction between safety and security, cyber safety and cybersecurity. We are cyber safety practitioners. Our job is not to, our job is focused on hygiene and making sure that we follow best practices and all that kind of stuff. If you look at airline safety, our job is to keep their airplanes well-maintained and flying and not falling out of the sky. If you look at airplane or aerospace security, our job is not to dodge Russian and Chinese missiles. We will have people, vast majority of us, if we got shot at by a Russian or Chinese missile, we get hit and come crashing down out of the sky.
Yeah. Well, look, on a related note, pivoting from shareholder protection to customer protection, I mean, look, I can't help but talk about TPRM again, because whether it was SolarWinds before or whether it was CDK Global, right? That was another a very recent big ransomware with a lot of concentration risk implications, similar to SolarWinds, or whether it was AT&T or Snowflake, right? We have some congressional inquiries around that. I fear that there's a lot of security professionals out there who are concluding, let's say you were affected by the SolarWinds breach, oh, we should have asked them more questions on the questionnaire. We should have asked some harder questions in the questionnaire. We shouldn't have backed down when we got an answer on the spreadsheet that we weren't happy with. And I think that's awful. Right? I mean, what was the right thing to do if you were a SolarWinds customer? That, you know, if you wind back the clock, what should you have done? Abandon ship? Ask them harder questions? Force them to do more encryption at rest? No.
So let me offer also... when the SolarWinds incident was unfolding, and they brought in the Mandiants of the world, they brought in, you know, whoever they could. I remember there was a comment that one of the folks who was looking at this, you know, they said, "What the Russians did, the SVR did, was sheer elegance." Okay, sheer elegance. And they realized that this was a compromise of the build process, okay? And they commented that they had not ever seen this anywhere else. Like, this is something that was, like, completely remarkable. And pretty much everyone, they recognized the sheer magnitude of how many people were vulnerable to this, okay? All right, so now let's go back to the TPRM. If you asked people at that point in time, hey, have you secured your build processes, and can you tell us, you know, how secure it is? We would have all failed.
As part of my TPRMs that we developed, that was an area that I always wanted to know. Okay, I want to know how your development works, how you're uploading code, and I did ask people. And you, I think with TPR, with all these third party assessments, you're just trying to get enough information to make a risk-based decision, okay? It's never going to be perfect. All the information you get, even if the information is relevant today, maybe something comes up tomorrow that makes all that information less relevant. The technology, for example, is now compromised or easily compromised the next day. You find out a zero vulnerability you weren't aware of. But you take risk-based approach based on the information you have. That's what these third-party assessments should be considered, right?
I wouldn't say disagree, but I think there's a whole piece we're missing here, right? So whether you're a customer of SolarWinds, Department of Treasury, Mandiant themselves, who got impacted by it, or whether you're a car dealership who had a material impact to your revenue because of a CDK Global outage, when you post-mortem that, when you root cause analyze that and figure out what should you have done different, what are you going to do different, the answer is not about diligencing the company better. The answer is not, oh, if only I had known, I wouldn't have used SolarWinds. Sunil had a really good point about that. I mean, it's very sophisticated. CDK Global, right? I'm sure we're all going to lampoon their security controls and all the crap we always do. Later on, we're going to shame them about how could they have had lateral movement available on EC2 and AWS and all that.
Right.
But that's not the answer of, oh, we shouldn't have used that software because they didn't have lateral movement protections. No. The answer, the only answer is going to be, we should have had contingencies for if every vendor's unavailable for any reason, including the CEO liquidating all the bank account walking out of town. And then secondly, the SolarWinds instance shouldn't have been able to call out to the frickin' internet. I'm sorry, people, but that's the problem. It's implementation. It should have been ring-fenced. What does it do? It pinged all of our servers, ICMP to the servers. Okay. What does it do? It goes out to the internet for updates. No, it doesn't. Stop that right now. Kill it. No egress. We're going to manually use change control to allow updates, et cetera. Does SolarWinds need to be able to resolve random domains that were registered by these Russian hackers? It was able to in every impacted environment. That means that the Department of Treasury, Mandiant, and all the other long tail of victims all had wide open surf the web access from a production server. That has to be the lesson learned here, because that's going to protect you from the next 45 of these things.
Right. And it's like going back to the earlier conversation about EDR. I mean, for one, let's just be clear. No EDR would have ever caught the SolarWinds attack. But if you had locked down egress filtering, you had a very clear understanding of what this system is supposed to do and allow nothing else, okay? Whether it's a voting machine, an ATM, or your SolarWinds server, those basic patterns that we know that creates defensible systems allows us to say, you know what, we don't need EDR, okay? Maybe we can simplify our system and not have to layer on all these compensating controls. The reason why we have these compensating controls is because you don't do that.
Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, like, there's a spectrum, right? From no control to completely locked down, and somewhere in the middle is monitoring. And I bet that's where our heroes Mandiant landed, because they found the damn thing. How? Because of all this DNS tunneling that was going out of the thing. And yeah, I'll proselytize they shouldn't have allowed it to connect, and we know it did, but at least they were watching and noticed it did. But God, I mean, we're all in this cybersecurity industry, and we have empirical data here that basically every company has all the production servers able to surf the web all day. What have we been doing?
I like that. I think customers need to look at the behavior of their traffic. They should spend, it's just like a credit card, like your credit cards, right? We use our credit cards. At the end of the month, do we not all look at our statements to see if any funky, funny stuff happened? Somebody charged something that shouldn't be charged? I do. We still do. My family does.
Well, so actually, there's one of the nice things that we have now in some of my payment systems is I can create a credit card that's intended for a specific vendor and only a specific vendor. So if for whatever reason that credit card number gets stolen and gets used by something, it automatically blocks it. It's a form of egress filtering, right? And I don't have to worry about ever spending, you know, someone doing fraudulent stuff on my credit card. Not that I care, because, you know, the bank will cover it. But it's a form of, you know, knowing this card is meant for this purpose, this server is meant for this purpose, and it's only going to be used for that purpose.
Yeah, it goes back to your diatribe and ephemerality. It's textbook ephemerality on these credit cards.
Yeah. Or in the case with what I'm arguing with, like these kiosk systems and such, make them as immutable as possible. There's really no reason for these systems to do anything beyond a very tightly scoped set of activities.
All right, guys. So if there's a big takeaway from the TPRM discussion, I hope you guys agree that it's kind of back to lowercase zero trust, right? Anything that you bring in the environment, assume it's compromised and architect it in a way that you could get over that, and don't try to questionnaire everything into compliance. Would you guys agree?
Well, I would say one takeaway from this CloudStrike event is let's understand where we need where we want to add complexity. If we want to add complexity, know that it has a cost. If we choose to increase concentration risk in some way, know that there's some cost there as well. At the end of the day, these actions have a cost. Nothing is free. There's trade-offs of some sort. But sometimes we don't really understand what those costs are. So now is an opportunity to count those costs.
I think there's an opportunity to reassess our position when we're using vendors. I mean, even as a secure and mature program like CrowdStrike, you got to do your due diligence, folks. You can't just walk away and fully trust these vendors. You have to do your own due diligence all the time, monitoring, testing, making sure configurations, making sure that credit card that was only meant to be used for one vendor payment that has not been changed to do something else. You still are a driver You customers are still the driver, and you need to spend time looking at these things.
Yeah. Well, thanks, guys. Yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to hopefully the next week we'll not have the same kind of Armageddon. And there's so many cyber stories going on. Hopefully all the affected sectors are able to recover well from this CrowdStrike issue, and we're able to look at this from a place that's not in the middle of the fire. And hopefully I win our bet on the price per share of CrowdStrike. All right, we didn't actually put any money behind it. But
I did.
Yeah, who needs a bet when you actually bought the stock? Yeah, there you go. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, thanks a ton. And as always, and I look forward to getting together for the next episode.